Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN in Geneva. Today is Tuesday, 24th of September. We have quite a heavy list of briefers connected to what's happening in the Middle East. So I've asked the colleagues who are on the podium with me to give you their announcements, and then we'll go into the topics. I'll start with Ed, who has to leave. Go ahead, Ed.
Sorry about that. Morning, everyone. Real fast before you jump into your very long and somber agenda, just a few more words on the launch of the Global Innovation Index. The embargo will be dropping at 9:30 on Thursday. We have a press briefing tomorrow. Everybody is willing, most welcome to join. It's at 3 p.m. That's also under embargo. I'll be sending around all of the materials this afternoon. You know about the GII. It ranks 130 countries around the world in the state of innovation, but also gives a lot more information on the state of innovation, which helps stimulate human ingenuity. So expect the press material later this afternoon, 3 p.m. tomorrow. Embargo is for 9:30 on Thursday morning. Thanks very much.
That was really perfectly fast and clear. Do you have any question for WIPO? I don't see any on the room. Let me look at the platform. Yes, there is Maya. Maya, you have the floor.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Alessandra, for taking my question. Mr. Harris, my question is related to the methodology, if you can actually give us more information about the methodology. And you said 30 countries only are examined?
130 countries. The methodology is quite interesting. It measures a mix of innovation inputs, which can be venture capital activity, research and development, as well as outputs, which is IP filings and others. There are 78 indicators, and it's brought into five different columns that kind of create this matrix through which you can understand the level of innovation in 130 economies around the world. But I ask you, Maya, please join tomorrow and hear from our experts. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ed. That was the only question for you. So thank you very much. If you need to leave, please. Adriana, I'll go to you. Adriana Quiñones. I am not sure everybody knows you. So Adriana is the director of the UN Women Liaison Office in Geneva. No, sorry. Deputy director. Sorry. Yes. I give you the floor.
Thank you very much. And head of human rights and development representing UN Women's work in the Human Rights Council. We're very proud today to welcome indigenous women human rights defenders from Guatemala who have worked for 30 years to achieve justice from sexual-related gender-based violence in the armed conflict. Over 25 years, they have struggled to get the only sentence existing in the world for sexual violence with 18 measures of reparations. For this delegation, they are coming, the indigenous women themselves, who speak their Mayan languages, with a high-level delegation from government. There will be two high-level events tomorrow, Wednesday, at 2 p.m. in room 22 of the Palais. We will hear their testimonies, as it is our goal as UN Women to bring the voices of women and girls and to institutionalize the lessons learned of victim and survivors' approaches to justice. Her Excellency Ambassador Michelle Taylor of the U.S. mission will be the moderator for this event, along with the participation of Spain, Sierra Leone, the Special Rapporteur on Indigenous Peoples, and the CEDAW Committee. Also, on Thursday, we will have an exhibition in the Palais of pictures of their trajectory in the search for truth, justice, and reparation. We welcome you all.
Thank you very much, Adriana. Any question to you and women in the room? I don't see any. Gabriela has one for you on the platform. Gabriela, welcome back. I'm so happy to see you.
Yes, thank you very much. Hola, Alessandra. I'm very happy too. And I'm happy that Adriana is here because she should come more often. My question is if is it possible to interview these women, indigenous women that are coming, are they going to be available? Thank you.
Yes, we will have them here until Friday morning. So we will welcome any opportunity to disseminate their voices and all that they have to contribute to justice, reconciliation, and peace. Please let us know.
Thank you very much, Adriana. And as Gabriela says, come more often. I'll turn to my left. Thomas, you also have an announcement about the meeting of the mayors.
Thank you. That's right. Next week, city leaders from across the globe will come together for the fourth Forum of Mayors here at the Palais. This will take place in room 17 from the 30th of September till the 1st of October, with over 45 mayors and deputy mayors attending the forum from all world regions, Europe and North America, from New Orleans to London, Vienna, Tallinn, Sofia, and Mykolaiv in Ukraine, to also mayors from other regions, including Buenos Aires, Dakar, Freetown, Lusaka, Rabat, and several others from the Middle East, from Latin America, and from Asia. Mayors will be discussing the implications for local governments of the Pact for the Future, which was agreed upon at the Summit of the Future over the weekend, as I'm sure you know. And at the forum, cities will draft an outcome statement on the future of cities, aiming to strengthen the engagement of local governments in the work of the United Nations and UN intergovernmental bodies and processes. And the Forum of Mayors, we remind you, is an example of that vision in practice. It's a pioneering initiative in the UN. And there's certainly a lot of interest from the cities in being involved in this and shaping the dialogue and discourse and intergovernmental work. We will share with you a full list of participating cities shortly, so please look out for that. We will facilitate contact with cities as desired. Following the forum, just a quick note, that there'll be a full-day meeting on housing affordability, the housing affordability crisis affecting Europe and North America. This will be informed by a report that we'll be releasing on housing stress, which is experienced by many households in the region, facing housing costs exceeding 45% of their income, which is much greater than the 30% rule, which is advised. Just to remind you there that the right to adequate housing is a human right recognized in international human rights law as part of the right to an adequate standard of living. We'll share that report with you under embargo and, of course, stand ready to facilitate contact. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Thomas. Any question to UNECE in the room or on the platform? I don't see any, so thank you very much. And I turn to another Thomas, Thomas Fitzsimmons for IPU.
Thank you very much, Alessandra. Good morning. Another Thomas, another conference to announce, this time for parliamentarians. So the 149th IPU Assembly will take place from 13 to 17 October in a few weeks' time at the International Conference Center, Rue de Varambe, just down the road. We're expecting hundreds of parliamentarians and experts from some 150 countries. The overall theme is harnessing science, technology, and innovation for a more peaceful and sustainable future. So on the back of the report, which was announced by my colleague from WIPO, there will be a particular focus on artificial intelligence, how to regulate, how to legislate, to mitigate the risks of AI while at the same time reaping the benefits. You should have received a media advisory in four languages this morning with more details. You are most welcome to come to the assembly, which is open to all UN-accredited media and journalists with a UN badge. It's a good opportunity, of course, to meet some of the leading parliamentarians and politicians, including from countries at war or in conflict situations, and the many countries who are in the news today. We have delegations already registered from Russia, the Russian Federation, from Palestine, and we're also expecting delegations from Ukraine, Israel, Lebanon, and many other countries from around the world. We'll also have both the speakers of parliament from Armenia and from Azerbaijan, who will also meet for the third time under the good offices of the IPU as part of overall peace and reconciliation efforts in the region. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Thomas. Thank you very much. Questions to IPU in the room? On the platform, there is Yuri, who wants to ask you a question.
Yes, thank you, Thomas. Just to be clear, do you know which day the head of the parliament of Azerbaijan and Armenia will meet? Thanks.
They will definitely be here on the 18th of October, which is just the day after the assembly. But we expect them to arrive a few days before. But I can get back to you with the specific dates.
Thank you very much. Please do, maybe for everybody's information. Thank you very much. So thanks to all colleagues for these brief briefings. And now let's go indeed to our main subject of today. Just for housekeeping reasons, please remember that at the end of Lebanon, we also have a guest from Nairobi who will speak to you about Sudan and the food situation. She comes from the World Food Program, Lenny Kinsley. But let me go now into what's happening at the moment in Lebanon. Yesterday evening, you probably have received the statement of the spokesperson for the Secretary General, who stated that the Secretary General is gravely alarmed by the escalating situation along the Blue Line and the large number of civilian casualties, including children and women, being reported by the Lebanese authorities, as well as thousands of displaced persons amidst the most intense Israeli bombing campaign since last October. The Secretary General is also gravely alarmed by the continued strikes by Hezbollah into Israel. He expresses grave concern for the safety of civilians on both sides of the Blue Line, including UN personnel, and strongly condemns the loss of lives. The Secretary General notes the ongoing efforts by UNSCOL and UNIFIL to reduce tensions and reiterates the urgent need for an immediate de-escalation and that all efforts be devoted to a diplomatic solution. The Secretary General reiterates his call for all parties to protect civilians and civilian infrastructure and ensure they are not put in harm's way. He also reminds all actors of their responsibility to ensure the safety and security of all UN personnel and assets. The Secretary General urges the parties to recommit to the full implementation of Security Council Resolution 1701, 2006, and immediately return to a cessation of hostilities to restore stability. And on this, yes, indeed, very, very grave situation, dire situation, we'll hear now from Ravina for the Office of the Human Rights High Commissioner. And then we will have online Etty Higgins, the UNICEF Deputy Representative in Lebanon, to understand better what is the impact of the situation on children. We'll have also Dr. Abdinasir Abubakar, who is the WHO representative in Lebanon, who will connect from Beirut. And Margaret should be in the room, although I don't see her. Maybe she's connected. And then we will hear from Matthew Salmash on the situation of the refugees in Lebanon. So let me start with Ravina. Thank you.
Thanks, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. We are extremely alarmed by the sharp escalation of hostilities between Israel and Hezbollah and call on all parties to immediately cease the violence and to ensure the protection of civilians. Yesterday marked the deadliest day of violence in years, with reports of at least 492 killed and 1,645 injured following a series of Israeli airstrikes across Lebanon. Lebanon's health ministry said that 35 children and 58 women were among those killed, as well as a number of medical workers. On a personal note, one of our UN human rights colleagues in Beirut lost 7 of her family members yesterday, including 2 children aged 8 and 1, in an Israeli airstrike in South Lebanon. Roads in southern Lebanon are crammed with people in cars fleeing the violence. This latest violence follows last week's deadly pager and two-way radio attacks in Lebanon and Syria and the firing of hundreds of rockets by Hezbollah into Israel from Lebanon. International humanitarian law is very clear. All parties to an armed conflict must at all times distinguish between the civilian population and combatants and between civilian objects and military objectives. Constant care must be taken to spare the civilian population and civilian objects. The laws of war also oblige all parties to observe the principle of proportionality. Incidents in which any civilians, including children and medical workers, are killed or seriously injured, potentially in violation of international law, must be subject to independent, thorough, and transparent investigations into the circumstances of the attacks. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, calls on all states and actors with influence in the region and beyond to avert further escalation and to do everything they can to ensure full respect for international law.
Thank you very much, Ravina. And now I give the floor to Etty Higgins, UNICEF Deputy Representative in Lebanon. Welcome to the press briefing in Geneva. You have the floor.
Thank you very much. And it's a very, very difficult morning here in Beirut. Indeed, as my colleague has just mentioned, we're seeing tragically the firsthand, and as my team are currently on the ground, the UNICEF team are currently on the ground supporting children who have been displaced and injured. I would like to really draw the highlight of the terrible and dangerous escalation that the situation has had and the adverse effects on children's physical and overall mental well-being. So as we have heard yesterday, at least 35 children have been killed reportedly, but this is more than the number of children killed in Lebanon in the past 11 months, which was 22. In addition, we still have more children who are missing under the rubble. And this is 11 months in one day, 35 children killed in one day, among close to 500 killed, 492 as reported by the Ministry of Health. We also have, unfortunately, almost 1,700 people who were injured yesterday, including children and women. That's, again, according to the Ministry of Public Health. And countless more children are in danger as I speak today. They're exposed to ongoing attacks. They're displaced from their homes, in some cases multiple times, and they're unable to rely on an overstretched and very much under-resourced health system. If we return to a conflict like those dark days of 2006, we really fear as UNICEF that this time it could be even worse for the children of Lebanon. Lebanon has recently been devastated by a protracted economic and political crisis and the massive Port of Beirut explosion, the impact of COVID-19, and the fifth year of a crippling economic downturn that has sent poverty rates soaring. Many families are already at the brink, and now this conflict is making every one of those factors many magnitudes worse. So we're warning today that any further escalation in this conflict will be absolutely catastrophic for all children in Lebanon, and especially families from towns and villages in the south and Bekaa in eastern Lebanon, where they have been forced to leave their homes. These newly displaced add to the 112,000 people who have already been displaced since last October. As of this morning, and the numbers are changing by the minute, we have 87 new shelters that have been opened. Many of them are in schools, accommodating the increasing number of displaced people in the south, in Beirut, in Mount Lebanon, in Baalbek, Hermel, Bekaa, and the Northern Governorates. So, of course, because many of the shelters are now schools have been closed today across the country. And in fact, the public schools have not yet even had the opportunity to reopen for the new school year due to the conflict. And this is leaving many children at home or in shelters in total fear. We're also getting reports that hundreds of children are caught en route across dangerous roads across the country. And their caregivers are themselves very afraid of the uncertainty of the situation. And this fear cannot be overstated as the barrage of shelling and air raids continue and increase daily. UNICEF has worked to support and protect the children of Lebanon for the last 76 years, and we are ramping up our response as we speak. We're preparing to deliver food, water, and essential supplies such as mattresses, blankets, hygiene kits to displaced and shattered families, especially those in collective shelters. We have already procured and delivered 100 metric tons of emergency medical supplies to hospitals facing severe shortages and supply stockouts, and have more medical supplies set to arrive by air, hopefully later this week. UNICEF urgently calls for an immediate de-escalation and for all parties to uphold their obligations under international humanitarian law to ensure the protection of civilian infrastructure and civilians, including children, humanitarian workers, and medical personnel. This includes facilitating the safe movement of civilians and especially children seeking safety. Yesterday was Lebanon's worst day in 18 years. This violence has to stop immediately, or the consequences will be unconscionable.
Thank you very much indeed. And I'd like to go now to Dr. Abdi Nasir Abubakar, the WHO representative in Lebanon. And Margaret is indeed with us, but online, also ready to answer your questions. Doctor, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. I think since the crisis started October 8th, WHO has been working very closely with the Minister of Health to prepare for the Lebanese health system for the management of possible mass casualty event while maintaining the delivery of essential health services. We have now seen how much this preparedness was needed and how much in return that we have received. I think since September 17, some of my colleagues have alluded that the Minister of Health have reported approximately 592, you know, deaths, including children, but also four healthcare workers. And we have a close to 6,500 people injured in total, including 16 paramedics. In total also, I have to say that 2,078 surgeries has been performed only for those who are wounded on the 17, 18, and the 20th of September. Currently, we have almost 1,000 people that are still receiving treatment in the hospitals across the country. And that is overwhelming the health system. And of course, we have thousands of displaced people who are in need of services. I have to say that the hospitals have been greatly challenged in managing the number of injuries since last week, and with thousands of wounded to bandages and surgery to perform. Over 90% of the major wounds are in the face and limbs, especially hands. And many people had have both eyes and hand injuries with the required two different sets of operations. And I have visited one or two hospitals during after the Beijing explosion, and I have seen how the brave healthcare workers are really working around the clock to help and serve for the people who are wounded. But all I've seen how the hospitals are managing, you know, this crisis. Some of them have overwhelmed and they have saturated into that. But at least the Minister of Health has really played a very important role to coordinate and how they are referring the patients from one hospital to another hospital. And almost 100 hospitals were involved with managing those wounded patients for September 17 and 18. WHO has been supporting with the health system for five. One, coordination of the national response, continuity of essential health services through the primary health care and secondary health care, mass casualty management, disease surveillance, and also prepositioning essential supplies for the hospitals as well as other locations. WHO continue to support the minister to establish and operationalize the Health Emergency Operations Center, which has a primary responsibility to coordinate and support the emergency response. Since October 8 last year, WHO has provided over 60 metric tons of essential emergency medical supplies, including surgical supplies, essential medicine, medical consumables, laboratory and blood transfusion supplies, and personal protection equipment for healthcare workers. We deliver more over the recent days. WHO also has delivered the blood bank supplies to the Lebanese Red Cross in the first quarter of this year. WHO has earlier worked with the minister to conduct a mass casualty management training, and those training were provided to more than 5,500 surgical and nursing staff and over 118 hospitals across the countries. These staff and their skills has proven to be critical in recent days, especially yesterday and also September 17 and 18. During the WHO also is working with the Minister of Health in updating the GIS data for better coordination and referral services and for better mapping of hospital capacity and occupants. During the times of war and uncertainty, mental health and psychosocial support services are also priority and is very critical. And WHO has worked with the partners and the Minister of Health to integrate these services into the hospital, making it easier for people to access the mental health and psychosocial care. Finally, we call the healthcare to be protected. And yesterday, several health responders were killed, unfortunately. And this is a strategy of a tragedy, not only for the loss of their family, friends, and colleagues, but also the entire health system and health sector in Lebanon. WHO stresses again that healthcare workers, facilities, and supplies, and the transport must be protected at all time and always. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'll go now to our colleague of UNHCR, Matt Saltmarsh, for an update on the situation of refugees.
Thank you, Alessandra, and good morning, everyone. Very much like our colleagues, as you've heard, we are gravely concerned about the serious escalation in the attacks that we saw yesterday. Tens of thousands of people were forced from their homes yesterday and overnight, and the numbers continue to grow. This is a region that has already been devastated by war and a country that knows suffering all too well. The toll on civilians is unacceptable, and the protection of civilians and civilian infrastructure in Lebanon is paramount. International humanitarian law must be upheld. An end to the hostilities is urgently needed, and now is the time for the international community to step up its support for Lebanon and its people. UNHCR is working tirelessly to provide urgent assistance and protection to all those affected, whether they are Lebanese or refugees. Even prior to the latest escalation, over 100,000 people had been displaced from the southern regions of Lebanon, and UNHCR had intervened to support them, whether they be IDPs or refugees, including with up to 120,000 emergency relief items and cash assistance for around 60,000 people. That was as of over a month ago. Also, we've been supporting collective shelters and ensuring safe access to healthcare and psychosocial support. Now, more recently, UNHCR is the lead on what's called the basic assistance sector. And as part of that, we are conducting assessments of potential shelter sites. That's already begun in Mount Lebanon and in Beirut, to look at the ability for people to stay there and the water and sanitation access to those sites. We're on standby to move into other areas around Beirut and Saida and in the Bekaa Valley. We've been working with the government to assess different collective shelters in those regions. And when we have the green light from them, we're ready to move in core assistance items and also provide cash assistance as is required. We're also working with the health ministry on the procurement of trauma kits. And of course, we will make available to them the supplies that we have for health and for to support Lebanese and refugees. In terms of the refugees in the country, I'm sure most people are aware it has for many years been a generous host, primarily to Syrian refugees. The government estimates there is now currently 1.5 million Syrian refugees in the country, as well as 87,000 refugees in the southern area before the latest events. They now, of course, those refugees face displacement once again, and that double displacement, of course, exacerbates their vulnerabilities. And indeed, those vulnerabilities were already very acute, having come through COVID, the economic downturn, and the impacts of the Beirut blast. There has been some movement of refugees into the northern areas. We don't have exact figures on that, as we don't have exact figures on the movement of Lebanese from overnight, but we can update those hopefully later in the day. Since the start of the crisis back in October 2023, we are aware of 33 Syrian nationals who have been killed by aerial strikes and 113 who have been injured. And like our colleague at UNICEF, we expect those figures will climb in the coming days. In terms of health coverage for Syrian refugees, we will continue to cover injuries sustained by Syrian refugees and hospitalization costs. Overall, we stand ready to further support the people of Lebanon, their government, and the refugees that they have so generously hosted for so many years. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mats. And now I will open the floor to questions. Before you are asking, Ravina's notes are in your mailbox. Solange is sending the UNICEF ones. And I count on, on Margaret and Matt, if they haven't done so yet, to send theirs. So I'll start now, and I see Moussa Assi. For our colleagues in the field, Moussa is the correspondent of Al-Mayadeen.
Merci, Alexandra. J'ai deux questions.
Can you get closer to the mic?
J'ai deux questions, une pour WHO et une pour concernant les réfugiés. Donc pour WHO, je voudrais savoir la capacité des hôpitaux au Liban. On a aujourd'hui 1650 blessés et quelques jours, on a eu 3500 à 4000 personnes blessées par les explosions de Pager. Est-ce que les hôpitaux au Liban ont la capacité de gérer tous ces flux? Et on s'attend bien sûr à une nouvelle vague de bombardements israéliens au Liban. Pour les réfugiés, on sait qu'il y a plusieurs centaines de milliers de Libanais. Ils ont fui le sud du Liban, et non pas des dizaines de milliers. Ils ont fui le sud, la Beka et la banlieue sud de Beyrouth. Il y en a qui ont passé plus que 24 heures dans leur voiture hier jusqu'à ce matin. Donc, ils n'ont pas réussi à atteindre des zones plus sécurisées. Est-ce que, donc j'aimerais savoir la situation de ces gens, parce qu'on a appris, je ne sais pas si c'est juste, qu'il y a des gens de certain âge, ils n'ont pas pu supporter cette attente, ils étaient malades et il y en a quelques morts dans leurs voitures. Alors, je voudrais savoir la situation, un petit peu plus de détails sur les gens qui sont toujours dans leurs voitures ou les gens qui n'ont pas encore trouvé de refuge. Merci beaucoup.
Okay, maybe just for our colleagues, a quick translation for Dr. Aboubakar. Colleague is asking whether what are the capacity in the Lebanon hospitals. There have been so many wounded people. The hospitals, have they got the capacity to manage this flux of wounded people, and also in view of next fighting? And for Matt, you understand French, right? I don't need to translate for you. Yeah, okay. So you will answer about the people fleeing north, Lebanese people fleeing north, and these elderly people that were caught in their cars, as I understand. So I'll give the floor to Dr. Aboubakar first.
Well, thank you very much for the question. I think in Lebanon, you know, of course, the country has been going through a very difficult time for the last few years. And I think in that crisis, financial crisis, you know, the Beirut blast, the pandemic, and many others, have impacted the health system in general. But I have to say that Lebanon has 165 hospitals in total, and with 8,900 bed capacity. And majority of them are the private sector, but both private and public sector actually have been responding to the current crisis. And I think capacity-wise, there are adequate number of hospitals, there are healthcare workers, but of course, they lack in the means to facilitate, to support the patient that's been wounded. For example, the supplies, for example, the operational cost and the fuel for the hospitals to run. As you know that in Lebanon, energy is a major challenge to have. But WHO, as well as other partners, we've been trying to see how we can, prepare for the eventuality. And that's why we train the healthcare workers. We enhance the capacity of the hospitals to manage. And I think what we have seen in September 17 was unprecedented, where almost 3,000 injured patients were actually admitted to the hospitals. And that has overwhelmed almost 100 hospitals across the countries. So that kind of a major event, it can overwhelm any health system, even developed health system. In the case of Lebanon, I think we managed to respond for that crisis, as well as the one for yesterday. But I have to say that in order for us to prepare in the future, we really need to do more to capacitate some of those hospitals where they need staffing, they need emergency supplies, the energy, and many other things that they need into that, especially including the blood transfusion that we really need to provide the testing as well as the blood bags into that. In summary, the capacity is there, but there is a support to complement, so at least they can deal with any eventuality, especially like what happened for the last few days.
Thank you very much, Matt.
I think Moussa's question was around people who are stuck in transport trying to get out of the south, move north. It's difficult to be...
Yeah, and the fact that some people apparently, especially elderly people, got sick in their cars and cannot get to safety.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can't provide really specific details on those cases. Of course, we work with the Lebanese authorities and we provide access where we can and support to refugees, but we also support the Lebanese authorities where we can. We're ready to step up and do that. We have contingency planning for the country that is now just starting to roll out. And we really are in that initial assessment phase where we're supporting the government, both in terms of access to health facilities, but also in assessing collective shelters and how we can bring in support there. So I think it's quite early days in that regard, but we're ready to do as much as we can to support the government, the Lebanese people, and of course refugees, and ensure that refugees have access initially now to health support and other essential items.
Thank you, Matt. Emma Farch, Reuters.
Thank you, Matt. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on the contingency plan. And do you have any exact number on how many have fled? I know you said tens of thousands, but do you have a count? And for the representative from the WHO, what type of injuries... Sorry, you mentioned that you were seeing injuries to the eyes and face. Could you just explain why there were so many of those types of injuries? Thanks very much.
Matt?
Well, in terms of contingency plans, you know, we've been working with the authorities, with other UN agencies for just this eventuality. And, you know, the time has come now to start rolling that out. It's around the provision of supplies that are in country, core relief items, protection assessments, and then protection interventions. Obviously, the immediate priority is shelter, it's healthcare, it's going to be water, and it's going to be food. I can give you a little bit more detail later on in the day, Emma, on that. At the moment, that's what I have. And in terms of the displacement of people, we just know what we see from the government at this stage, which is that, you know, we're looking at tens of thousands, but we expect that those figures will start to rise. And as I said earlier on, there was already significant displacement from the south even before this latest escalation. So the situation is extremely alarming. It's very chaotic, and we are doing what we can to support the government.
Dr. Aboubakar?
Yeah, as I said earlier, you know, the wound, we are referring to the event that happened on September 17 and 18. So most of those, you know, injuries were related to the hands and the face and the head, actually. And the reason why being is because of the pagers and the handheld devices people were using, actually, either to look the number that has dialed or maybe to speak to the VHF radio. And that's why most of the wounds actually are related to the eye and the face. And I think subsequently, most of the people who are still in admission in the hospitals, these are people who are still waiting for surgery, but also waiting for amputation and related element in the hospitals. And please note that this is one of the unprecedented incidents, because we have never seen so much of injuries related to the hands and face and ears, and requires more specialized doctors actually to handle into that. And that's why many of them are still in the hospital waiting for this surgery.
Thank you very much. Mohammed, our correspondent from the Turkish news agency.
Thank you so much, Alessandra. My question is for Ravina. Ravina, you already mentioned Israel has intensified its attack on the south part of Lebanon. You know, these attacks carry the risk of Lebanon turning into a new Gaza. How do you evaluate this possibility? And can the region, which is already tense, handle this action by Israel? Thank you.
Thanks, Mohammed. Everything that you've heard from our colleagues about the impact on healthcare, on children, on people who are already refugees, who are already displaced, having to be re-displaced. We're seeing schools turning into shelters. We're seeing churches turning into shelters. Have we not learned anything from what has been happening in Gaza over the past year? We are extremely concerned about this spillover. This is not normal. This is extremely abnormal when you have people losing their eyes and when you have hospitals not able to cope with the amount of amputations that they need to carry out. We've heard all this before, haven't we, last year and throughout the past year. This is not normal, and this needs to stop. The High Commissioner is calling for an immediate de-escalation. The United Nations General Assembly is meeting. World leaders are gathering in New York. They need to prioritize bringing this conflict to an end. There needs to be a ceasefire in Gaza. The hostages need to be released, and this new front of the conflict, it needs to be stemmed. The escalating rhetoric and the escalating attacks need to stop, and the international community and all states with leverage over the parties to the conflict need to exercise this leverage now.
Indeed, really, the message is we need to come back from the brink. We need all the parties to the conflict to come back from the brink. We need everybody to push them to do so. I think the Secretary General has been extremely adamant on that also in his messages, several messages. Nina Larsson, AFP.
Yeah. Hi, thanks. First for Rabina, I was wondering about the messages that were sent out to Lebanese yesterday or that they reportedly received from the Israelis warning them to move away from Hezbollah. Potential Hezbollah targets. It's been described as potentially psychological warfare, given that people don't necessarily know where those targets are. And it's so I was just wondering if you could say a little bit about that use of sending messages like that. And then for Matt, I just had a question. I think you mentioned the Syrian refugees in Lebanon. I was also wondering about the Palestinian refugees who have also been obviously following what's been going on in Gaza to other Palestinians there. I know that UNHCR doesn't have Palestinians under its mandate, but maybe you could say something about them as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Nina. As you pointed out, these tens of thousands of messages that arrived on people's cell phones spread panic, fear, and absolute chaos. There was the assumption that civilians know where any weapons may have been stored. And to be clear, international humanitarian law, if you warn people of an imminent attack, that does not absolve you of the responsibility to protect civilians. The obligation to protect civilians is paramount. So whether you've sent out a warning telling civilians to flee doesn't make it okay to then strike those areas knowing full well that the impact on civilians will be huge. All feasible precautions must be taken to spare civilians, and attacks have to remain proportional to the wider damage that they inflict. And it is also important to note that those who may be members of a particular group but are not actively taking a direct part in hostilities cannot be targeted. At their core, the rules of international humanitarian law are there to effectively protect civilians and thus our common humanity. What we are seeing here raises fundamental questions about respect for international humanitarian law.
Indeed. Don't see other hands. Oh, yeah, sorry. Ah, that's right, Matt, yeah. And then I also saw the doctor putting his hand up. So if you want to intervene, doctor, no worries. Just keep your hand up and I'll give you the floor. Matt.
So in terms of our role, Nina, as you mentioned, we don't formally have the mandate to assist Palestinian refugees, of which I believe there are some 400,000 registered in the country. However, normally we would make our assistance available across the country to those most in need. So that's our position right now. If there's any update on that or any further development on that, I can get back to you in the course of today. But that's the position as far as I know.
Thank you very much. So, Doctor, it's Mrs. Higgins also who wants the floor. Etty, please.
Thank you. Yes, I just wanted to maybe say a few words on the Palestinian camps, because UNICEF is working closely with UNRWA in particular on the Palestinian camps and on the population that are impacted there. And what I can say is that we've seen a huge crisis over the past 6 months and since the beginning of the war on children's mental health in particular, and on their access to services as well. We've had a lot of forced displacement of people coming in and out of the Palestinian camps. And we've seen real increases in tension there also, and seeing that this psychological toll is really having an impact and triggering really overwhelming levels of stress, anxiety, and fear across the community. And so we've mobilized large numbers of psychologists and frontline workers, and we provide psychosocial first aid in the Palestinian camps. But there is, of course, intergenerational trauma of them having been displaced and now seeing what is happening, of course, in Gaza and the West Bank to their extended family members. And now, in addition with the increase in violence in Lebanon, we're really seeing the children that are coming to our kindergartens and our nurseries in the camps to be showing signs of a lot of trauma, as well as their mothers and caregivers and family members, extended family members, also coming for support to our centres that we operate across Palestinian camps. And in fact, we were due to release, depending on the situation here, a report on the situation on mental health in particular of Palestinian residents in the camps. Over.
Thank you very much. I don't see other hands in the room, so I'll go to the platform. There are many questions. Okay, so I'll start with Yuri, who's been patiently waiting. Sorry, I am not everybody knows all the correspondent. Yuri Aprelef is the correspondent of RIA Novosti.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. My question is for, I think, Ravina, almost for them. The first one is that your office have access to Lebanon. So are you already investigating these bombings? And during your opening remarks, I noted that you didn't name directly Israel in the statement, I mean, that you made. Can you, why, just to understand, why is it a political reason or why? And thirdly, my question is about the fact that with at least 500 1,600 wounded in a single day, can we talk about war crime in this situation? And the last, but I think maybe it's more for WHO, but I'm not sure if someone has this information. Do you know if the majority of these dead and wounded are civilians or members of Hezbollah? Because this is quite hard to understand when you are talking about death and injured, if we are talking about combatants or if we are talking about civilians. Thank you.
Okay, Ravina, maybe then I'll ask WHO if they can complement.
Thanks, Yuri. On our presence in Lebanon, yes, we have 7 international staff in Lebanon and some national staff as well. They have very limited ability to be able to monitor the situation, but indeed they are. They are producing regular monitoring reports to inform us, to inform the office on advocacy, on reaching out to member states, speaking publicly about the issues. It is a limited capacity, though, and what they are also trying to do is to try to verify civilian casualties. But again, this will take time. On your misunderstanding that we didn't name Israel, well, of course we did. The Israeli Defense Forces themselves have made it clear that these are Israeli strikes, and our note makes that clear as well. We speak of a series of Israeli strikes across Lebanon. And on whether this would amount to war crimes, as I said earlier, the methods and means of warfare that are being used raise serious concerns about whether this is compliant with international humanitarian law. The fact that there is a large number of casualties and a large number of injuries, large number of displacement, some civilian facilities also that have been hit, raises serious questions about compliance with international human rights and humanitarian law.
Thank you. Doctor, do you have any more detail on the deaths and wounded?
Well, thank you very much. I think, first of all, I think we don't have the breakdown of who is civilian and who is the combatant. And that's not our role and a mandate, actually, to classify, you know, the wounded mission where they belong to. I think we rely on the Minister of Health reports. But what's important is, under the international humanitarian law, all injuries have the right for treatment. And our job is to save lives. And I think that's the most important element that we are dealing with. I think we are working with the Minister of Health. And I think the report that we're getting from the Minister of Health is majority of these people, you know, likely to be civilian, as we have seen the 35 children. And also there are a number of women actually that included into that. So based on what we have, the Minister of Health, I think what we can see, there are more civilians who have been wounded and those who have died. But according to WHO, I think our, you know, position is that all injuries who come to the hospitals, they have the right to be treated as part of international humanitarian law.
Thank you very much. Jeremy Lange, correspondent of Radio France Internationale.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to go back to what Ravina said about the fact that you cannot strike members of a group that are not active combatants. I'd like to know if you can elaborate a bit more on that. Basically, what we're seeing in Lebanon do you fear that what we're seeing in Lebanon is actually what we saw in Gaza, meaning that Israel consider it okay to strike any building that, as long as you have a Hamas or a Hezbollah militant in the building? Is that what we're heading to? That's the first question, and maybe a second question of on the closure of Al Jazeera bureau in the West Bank, in a territory that is normally under the control of the Palestinian Authority. Do you have a comment on that particular subject? Thank you, Ravina.
Thank you, Jeremy. On the law, first of all, armed force can only be used against a legitimate military target to achieve a valid military objective. Even when you do identify a valid military objective, a legitimate military target, the fundamental distinction between civilian and military targets needs to be front and center. And even where you have identified a target, all feasible precautions need to be taken to ensure that civilians are spared. The attacks have to remain proportional to the wider impact that they inflict on civilian lives and civilian infrastructure. And people who are not exercising a continuous combat function in an armed group can only be targeted when they are taking direct part in hostilities. So international humanitarian law is very clear on this. And the interpretation has to first and foremost place the protection of civilians at its core. That was the basis, the spirit of international humanitarian law. What we are worried about is that we are seeing a stretching of these boundaries and an expansive view of the interpretation of international humanitarian law, which is straying from the spirit of the law. And this is why the High Commissioner, when he spoke to the Security Council on Friday regarding this situation, expressed serious concern about the erosion of international law to its core. And he stressed that the preservation and protection and respect for international law is a matter of international peace and security. So it should raise alarm bells for every member state that's part of the United Nations.
Thank you.
And then, yes. on your separate question on Al Jazeera. No, of course, we're very concerned about what happened. Our office in our Palestine office, which is based in Amman, issued a tweet on this yesterday, and I will share with you our concerns. We are deeply alarmed by Israel's misuse of counterterrorism laws to close Al Jazeera's office in Ramallah, which is one more measure in the systemic suppression of freedom of the press and expression in the occupied Palestinian territory.
And on this particular issue, I will also refer you to the statement, what the spokesperson of the Secretary General said yesterday, the noon briefing, where he also expressed extreme concern about this event. He said that this probably placed, he says, to a bigger picture in limiting media coverage of what is going on in the region, including in Gaza, where we see that no international journalists are allowed in unless they come in with the IDF from the north. It's also a reflection of a trend that we are seeing globally, which hampers the work of journalists. And he underlined the importance of having free and unimpeded work of the press, especially in conflict areas. I'll go now to, who's the next? John Zarokostas, our correspondent of France 24.
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me there?
We can, John. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. My first question is to the WHO representative. I was wondering, sir, if you have details on reports that health facilities and ambulances have also been attacked. I've got a question from Matt. If you could bring us up to speed, do you have the number of Iraqi refugees that are still in Lebanon, and if they're protected as well? And the procurement of the medical supplies, are you doing it through the WHO as the lead in the health cluster or independently? And to Ravina, if you could send us the links to the relevant international humanitarian law that you mentioned is being breached in this situation because there's so many agreements, it'd be nice to send us a fact sheet of which clauses you're referring to. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's start with Dr. Aboubakar.
Yes, well, yes, thank you very much. I think, you know, since the crisis started, we have witnessed a repeated attack of health facilities and healthcare workers and ambulances as well. And that's why the WHO has mandated as part of the, we are collecting that information. We have a very effective surveillance system to monitor and also to document. And what happened, you know, yesterday, and I think what we have seen is 4 healthcare workers were killed, and 16 paramedics, mostly working in ambulances, were attacked, actually. Not to mention the health facilities that has been attacked as well. So I think, yes, we have some evidence and we have some documentation that shows that at least there were some attacks of health facilities, you know, the ambulances, as well as the healthcare workers. And this will impact, you know, the overall health sector, because we cannot afford to lose any life in this conflict. And that's why WHO is advocating that the protection of healthcare workers and health facilities is paramount, and we have to protect and we have to always advocate the protection of those, because it's very critical, especially in the context of Lebanon, where we have a crisis of the healthcare workers, you know, the number of healthcare workers, the shortage of healthcare workers. So we cannot afford to lose anyone in the crisis and before and after.
Thank you, Matt. On the Iraqi refugees?
Yeah, to John's question on Iraqi refugees, yes, there are still Iraqi refugees in the country. We currently have 4,850 registered in the country, and indeed other nationalities as well. And all of those nationalities are included in the interagency response program. In terms of John's question on the procurement, we are the co-lead and co-coordinator in the health sector. And we are maximizing our efforts to respond to the current needs. In terms of the details of how the procurement is done, I'll check on that, John, and let me get back to you. I don't have details right now, so I wouldn't want to give you some misinformation on that.
Thank you, Ravina.
Yes, John, definitely we can share with you the relevant excerpts on the law.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Gabriela, I know you had another question for Ravina, but I understand this one is on Lebanon, so I'll give you the floor now.
Yes, thank you very much, Alessandra. We saw in Gaza that Israel does not have much respect for civilians. I would say that they don't care at all. But my question is, if in Lebanon, Hezbollah is protecting civilians? That's one question. And the second one, to Adriana of UN Women, if she's still there, or UNICEF, what is the situation of women and girls in Lebanon? Thank you.
Thank you. No, unfortunately, Adriana has left, but I'll give the floor to Ravina. Maybe then Eti can answer on this issue. She also put a note in the chat. Maybe you can also say it's live, because people, not everybody has access to the chat. So I'll start with Ravina.
Thanks, Gabriela. No, let us be clear. Hezbollah has been firing hundreds of rockets into Israel. So there are serious concerns there as well regarding the conduct of the means and methods used in warfare, the indiscriminate nature of the attacks as well. Let's be very clear on that. And our calls for the respect for international humanitarian law go to all parties to the conflict. And this, of course, includes Hezbollah.
Absolutely. And the Secretary General has also spoken about both warring parties. Maybe, Ati, you want to say something about women and girls and then read what you put in the chat?
Yes, very quickly. Thank you. Two points that I put in the chat. One is that we have, as of this morning, in the last half an hour, 16,500 displaced as per the government figures. And this is likely to increase drastically in the coming hours. On medical supplies, I think somebody asked about medical supplies. As UNICEF, we've procured and delivered 100 tons of emergency medical supplies to hospitals who are facing severe shortages and supply stockouts, and have more medical supplies set to arrive this week. That's depending on the airport remaining open and our ability to actually have aircraft to come in and deliver the goods. What I will also say is that as of this morning as well, we're getting reports, as I've been speaking to you, of children arriving with basically only the clothes that they left in a hurry, that many children slept in cars and on the side of roads last night across the country in Beirut, but also in Saida. I wanted to flag, it hasn't come up, but a lot of the first frontline responders in Lebanon have themselves suffered. So our NGO partners and our own staff and their own family members have also been injured, killed, impacted, and have been displaced. So what will really complicate the response in Lebanon is that the scale of the displacement. Last night, speaking to some of our NGO partners and frontline workers, they themselves were fleeing and looking for areas of safety. They said that the bombardment was all around them when I spoke to one in Baalbek. I wanted to mention as well that we're getting reports as well of young women and girls who have lacking access to things like sanitary pads and hygiene kits. And as well as that, in the shelters that have been open and operating for quite some time, since the start of the crisis, we really witnessed an increase of DBV cases and a lot of girls getting involved in child labour and really putting them at higher risk of sexual harassment and sexual abuse as well in the shelters. So this is something that we're very, very highly aware of as well, that these shelters need to be made safe from the very beginning when vulnerable families arrive with nothing, that we put these safe, that we put the prevention of sexual exploitation and abuse mechanisms in place immediately, given that these families, and especially women and girls, are at their most vulnerable.
Thank you very much, Etsy. Jamie Keaton, Associated Press.
Thanks, Alessandra. I had a question. I guess this is for either Dr. Abubakar or Ms. Higgins. About the impact of the pager and walkie-talkie strikes last week. Is there any sign that you have seen that the evacuations or other communications in Lebanon after yesterday's events were impeded because of the strikes last week? In other words, did those attacks on the communications devices thwart or impede people from being told about what was happening yesterday in the military action?
Dr. Abubakar or Ati, I don't know who would like to take this one from the ground, from the field.
Well, I have to say that, unfortunately, I'm not in a position to answer because I'm not the one managing the patient transportation from the field to the hospital. These are the emergency medical services and the Lebanese Red Cross who are dealing with that. So I think maybe the Minister of Health and those emergency medical services will be in a better position to answer that question. And I'm Sorry for that.
Do you have anything to complement, Etty?
No, I mean, you talked about the question was about the impact on children. Of course, I mean, I could talk about the children that were injured in the attack last week. One of the cases was a little girl who was handing, and I think it was widely reported in the media when she was handing the device to her father, and it exploded and killed her. But we also have cases that have not been covered by the media where children have lost their sight and have sustained severe damage to their hands, as Dr. Abdi has mentioned as well. And these are really life-threatening in some cases, and life-changing disabilities that they will have to live with for the rest of their lives. And of course, as Dr. Abdi has also mentioned, the health system is just not set up to deal with the severity and massive influx of these cases of severe injuries and also deaths. UNICEF has, as I've mentioned, a long-standing support to the Ministry of Health, but for the first time yesterday, we were asked to provide refrigerated trucks, and we were asked to provide a storage space for the remains of those who were killed, including the women and children, 35 children at least killed yesterday. And I had reports this morning. Of course, unfortunately, we weren't able to support with a mobile mortuary or cold storage vehicles for the remains of those who were killed. But we also have family members who are trying to find family members that are still buried under the rubble. One staff member this morning has lost over 7 members of her family, and we expect that number to rise in the hours ahead.
I'm really sorry for that. Thank you very much. So I have a last question, and then Gabriela, we will go to Sudan, but Ravina will stay to answer your question on another subject. Oh, sorry, I see Yuri as also. Okay, let me give the floor to Nick and Yuri, and then we will go to Sudan because our colleague has been patiently waiting, and then I'll go back to Ravina. Nick Amin-Bruce, our correspondent of the New York Times.
Yeah, thank you. The question for Dr. Abdi. I wonder if you could just give us more details specifically about the deaths of the 4 healthcare workers. Were they working in fixed sites in medical clinics at the time? And were these struck by shells or aircraft, or were they out on the road? Was there any evidence that you said that there had been some healthcare facilities that were hit? These clinics, were they targeted? Could you give us a bit more detail on this, please?
Dr. Abubakar?
Thank you very much, Nick. Nick, I know that some of those healthcare workers actually were in the ambulances and they were actually doing the emergency services. But the details of how and where and why, I think I would be able to provide you in written to that, because I need to get more detailed information from the Minister of Health, as well as our team who are doing the surveillance.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Okay, so as Yuri's question is not on Lebanon, I will now close this item of the briefing. I would like to really thank everyone who has spoken, has intervened, especially our colleagues in Lebanon, to whom we really wish well for the next days and in this very dire situation. I'd like to go now to our colleague of the World Food Programme, Lenny Kingsley. Thank you very much for your patience, Lenny. You have an update on the food situation in Sudan.
And it's been very tragic to hear everything that's been happening in Lebanon, but it's just as important that we keep also attention on Sudan, as the situation is extremely critical there, especially after now 18 months of fighting. And today, the United Nations World Food Programme is announcing that we're in a race against time to save lives in the war-torn country, as 1.5 million people are either facing famine or at risk of famine. And without urgent assistance, hundreds of thousands could die. And we are working tirelessly to get aid into the hands of people who are facing starvation, but we are saving thousands of lives every single day in Sudan. So far this year, we've supported 5.4 million people with life-saving food and nutrition assistance. And as we speak, we are urgently getting basic staple foods into the hands of 180,000 people facing famine in Zamzam camp in North Darfur. Vulnerable communities are receiving a package of wheat flour, lentils, oil, and salt. And meanwhile, in Khartoum, WFP is supporting community kitchens to provide 175,000 hot meals on a daily basis. We've also just started in-kind food distributions for around 155,000 people in Karadi and Umdurman neighborhoods of Khartoum, where people will receive two-month rations. And 16,000 people in the metropolitan area received mobile money transfers in July and August, as WFP plans to increase this number throughout the course of this month. We've also launched self-registration pilots to expand mobile money transfers to North and South Darfur, South Kordofan, and Jazeera State. And WFP is also taking advantage of the reopening of the Adre border from Chad into the conflict-rattled Darfur region. Trucks carrying vital food and nutrition supplies are crossing that border every single day, despite facing delays due to flooded seasonal rivers and muddy road conditions where aid convoys are getting stuck. Since Adre reopened 1 month ago, we've transported 2,800 metric tons of food and nutrition supplies into the Darfur region, and that's enough aid for over 250,000 people. Of that, 100,000 people in risk of famine areas in West Darfur have also received emergency food and nutrition supplies. Even though we are doing everything we can, it's just a drop in the ocean compared to the needs, not just in Sudan, but regionally. Around 36 million people have been pushed into hunger because of this ongoing war. I was recently in Adre, Chad, where around 800,000 people have fled to. After enduring unimaginable violence, people are only met with hunger and destitution. Despite receiving food assistance, many are struggling to get by, eating once a day if they are lucky. Like a teenage girl I met called Turaya, who lost her parents and is taking care of her younger siblings. Sometimes she's only able to offer them water instead of a meal. If that is the situation for people in a comparably safe and stable place, it is hard to imagine what people facing famine or at risk of famine in Sudan are going through. I did get a glimpse, though, speaking with women who recently fled from areas of risk at famine, like a woman I met called Najwa. She, along with other new arrivals, risked their lives to get to safety in Chad because there was nothing left to eat and all their crops had been destroyed by floods. Others said they could not even farm because it was too unsafe to go to their fields, which is also why they fled to Chad. Health and nutrition workers in the Adre camp told me that over half of their malnutrition cases there were from new arrivals coming from risk of famine areas in Sudan. It is exactly for people like Suraya and Najwa, who are among tens of millions bearing the brunt of the brutal war in Sudan, that world leaders need to pay attention and step up for during this high-level week in New York. WFP and other agencies cannot tackle these challenges alone. We are doing everything we can, but we cannot stop widespread starvation and hunger-related deaths without the support and attention of the international community. World leaders need to give this humanitarian catastrophe the attention it requires. That attention then needs to be translated into concerted diplomatic efforts at the highest levels to push for a humanitarian ceasefire and ultimately an end to the conflict. We also need the international community to step up in demanding that the warring parties guarantee safe and unfettered humanitarian access and adhere to international humanitarian law. Lastly, we need a surge in funding to address the extraordinary level of need, over $600 million in the coming 6 months to provide urgent aid to people in the most severe levels of hunger across the region. We would require even more to help all those millions who need help. For over 500 days, the Sudanese people had been bearing the brunt of this war, feeling forgotten and abandoned by the world. They are still holding on to the hope that one day they can return to their lives. Together, we owe it to the Sudanese people to step up collective action and prevent mass-scale starvation. The hopes of the Sudanese people, their future, are riding on what we do next. We cannot let them down. Thank you very much. And over to any questions.
Thank you very much, Lenny. You are absolutely right. We need to keep focusing on crises so important like Sudan. And I am looking at the journalist now if there's any question for you on this very dire situation. I don't see any in the room. And I don't see any in the platform because Gabriela and Yuri are waiting to ask other questions. But please share your notes with our correspondents, or we will do it for you so that this important information is kept and used. Thank you. So I'll go now to Gabriela. You have a question for Ravina. Ravina has been waiting here to answer.
Yes, thank you very much, Alessandra. My question is on militarization of public security in Mexico. It's kind of complicated. I will try to explain it. Last week, the National Guard was transferred to the army, to Sedena, that is the Ministry of the Army in Mexico. When it was created, it was said that it would be led by a civilian, and the nature of Guardia Nacional would be civilian, but that was never fulfilled. On April 2019, the government signed a collaboration and advisory agreement with the Human Rights Office of the United Nations, with the presence of Michelle Bachelet, former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, and the President of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. This agreement was signed. Civil society said that a military commander was in charge of Guardia Nacional and not a civilian, as had been agreed. So López Obrador reiterated the National Guard promised to maintain a line of respect for individual guarantees. But integrating the National Guard into Secretary of Defense increases human rights violations. That is what civil society say. So my question is, are you concerned of this? What will happen with your memorandum with the government? Is your office supporting militarization of public security in Mexico? And if UNICEF is there, are you concerned that militarization will affect especially women and girls? Thank you very much.
Thanks to you, Gabriela, for this long question. I'll give the floor to Ravina on UNICEF. I'm not sure that we have, because James is traveling to the Middle East, so I think maybe you would all want to ask this in writing to him. Ravina.
Thank you, Gabriela. Are we concerned? Yes, we are. As you know, we have been addressing this issue for a long time. Our office, as well as other UN human rights mechanisms, have consistently cautioned against expanding the armed forces' role in security tasks. And we have pointed out that this approach has not sustainably reduced violence, and instead it has led to serious human rights violations. We reiterate the importance of ensuring that the civilian nature of the National Guard is prioritized and that there are robust accountability mechanisms. And we remind that the armed forces should only be deployed temporarily for security tasks in exceptional circumstances, subordinate to civilian authorities, and always under the effective supervision of independent civilian bodies. We acknowledge Mexico's complex challenges in addressing violence, but it is important that our consistent caution against expanding the armed forces' role in security tasks is respected.
Thank you very much. Gabriela, you have a follow-up?
Yes. So what will happen with your agreement with the government of Mexico on Guardia Nacional?
I mean, I can't get into any details on that. We, as you know, we have an office in Mexico that's been longstanding and working on a variety of issues, including this one. On that, I won't be able to go any further.
Yuri, you also have a question to Ravina.
Yes, thank you. This is a question so far not on Lebanon. This morning, one of the representatives of the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Rodion Mirushkin, told that Russia has a nominative list of civilians from the Kursk Oblast who has been arrested by the Ukrainian army. He said also that between 70 and 120 civilians were also detained in a building in Sudja. I just wondering if you have any information on that, or if you are working to know what is happening and just to verify this information. Thank you.
Thanks, Yuri. I'll have to check with my colleagues if this list has been shared with our office. Our office has, of course, reached out to the Russian authorities on the situation in Kursk and elsewhere. So I'll just have to check if we have received this list or not, and we can get back to you.
Thank you, Ravina. Satoko Adashi has the Yumiri Shimbun has a question for Margaret. Margaret Harris.
Yes, thank you. I just wondering, could you give us some update on the polio campaign in Gaza, specifically the second run of the campaign? Thank you.
Yes, indeed.
Hi.
Margaret, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, the polio campaign is in the planning stages. It is hoped that it could be done mid-October. And just as with the previous round, and it's really important that we do this second round, but just as with this previous round, we need for the pause in fighting to hold. Ideally, of course, what we all want is a ceasefire, but it is essential and it can't go ahead unless we also get those pauses in fighting. And currently, we don't have a date, but we're hoping for mid-October.
Thank you very much, Margaret, and please keep us updated on this issue. There are quite a few journalists who have asked questions about that. So thank you to everyone. I just have a few announcements for you. First of all, very quickly, two international days, I think quite important ones, on the 26th of September, the International Day for the Total Elimination of Nuclear Weapons, and also on the 26th, the World Maritime Day. We've sent you the statements, the messages of the Secretary General on these matters. The Human Rights Committee, we have the Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, which will conclude Friday its session. And the Committee on Enforced Disappearances, which is concluding this morning the review of Ukraine. And this afternoon we'll start the consideration of the report of Morocco. Just very quickly, a word about what's going to happen today in New York at 9 a.m. New York time in the General Assembly Hall. The general debate of the 79th session of the General Assembly will begin. The theme for the 79th session is leaving no one behind, acting together for the advancement of peace, sustainable development, and human dignity for present and future generations. The Secretary General and the President of the General Assembly will address the session. There will be a very long list of speakers, including many presidents, heads of states, governments. And today, on the first day, among other participants, we see the presidents of Brazil and the United States. All the debates, as you know, are webcast on UN Web TV. And there are also a list of high-level events which are organized by the General Assembly, which is available on the internet. Don't hesitate to ask us. In particular, the SDG moment, sorry, there are three high-level meetings that I wanted to mention, the one on sea level rise, that's tomorrow. On Thursday, the high-level meeting on antimicrobial resistance, and I'm sure that Margaret can answer a question on that. That will be with the Director General of WHO, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, among other speakers. And the high-level meeting on support for UNRWA, which will also happen on the 26th at 1 p.m. New York time, and will also be available for you on the web. And finally, the high-level meeting on the International Day of Total Elimination of nuclear weapons that I've just mentioned. Just also to remind you that this afternoon, the Security Council, this afternoon, New York Times, will hold a debate on the situation of peace and security in Ukraine. And a very last point to remind you that I think we have sent you an information on that, that the Secretary General has convened the SDG Moment 2024. This is going to happen today at 1:30 New York time, and it will show how transformation is not only possible but essential, building on the momentum from the 2023 SDG Summer and the outcomes of the Summit of the Future. Again, everything is on UN Web TV. I see Gabriela has a question. I don't know if it's for me.
It's for Ravina, if she's still there.
She was hoping to leave, but she comes back on the
board. Maybe to you. Thank you so much, Ravina. Maybe to you as well, Alessandra. Why Human Rights Council is at the same time that General Assembly? It could be more to October or something like that. I mean, we have to cover sometimes New York and Human Rights Council at the same time, and it's really hard.
I don't know what you think, Ravina. As you know, Gabriela, the Human Rights Council meets three times a year, and for ever longer periods, they are expanding slowly, but steadily. I don't know if we can make any difference to that, but you know why? It's just two different locations, two different sets of delegates, and you are right. Maybe it can be a little bit difficult sometimes for the press, but... maybe you can bring this to the attention of the Human Rights Council colleagues, Ravina.
I can certainly bring it to Pascal's attention. I'm not sure how much power he has over the scheduling of these meetings either. Gabriela, just to share your frustration, we are completely overwhelmed. There's a lot of demands on the UN Human Rights Office, and we just hope that member states will give us the commensurate funds to be able to cover all the requests, increasing requests that are coming through the increasing meetings of these bodies.
Gabriela.
Do you have an idea of how much money do you need to work properly?
Let's talk. We have, we have various appeals that the High Commissioner has made to member states on the budget shortfalls resulting from the liquidity crisis and also generally, but we'll be happy to share the figures with you, and I can do those by email.
Any other question for me, Ravina, or anybody else in the room or on the platform? So thank you very much. It's time to tell you bon appétit and tell you, and I'll see you on Friday. Thank you.